The Real World Entrepreneurship Podcast with Bhairav Patel and Alan Clark.
Welcome to the Real World Entrepreneurship Podcast, where we tackle the practical challenges that startup founders and small business owners face and give our own unvarnished opinions. My name is Bhairav Patel. I'm the Managing Director at Atom Ventures and Atom CTO, where we partner with small businesses and startup founders to help them define and build their tech vision.
And I'm Alan Clark. I'm the founder of the Business Growth Partnership, and we work with high-potential businesses to help them unblock the blockages that are preventing them from reaching their full potential.
Hi, everybody. Welcome along to this episode. Today, we're going to have a chat about scaling. We've covered this before, but the particular relevance right now is that Bhairav and his team are going through another growth exercise with his business. So Bhairav, tell us the background about what's been going on.
Yeah, so during COVID, we did manage to grow the business. So we started off with, I guess, four of us, then it turned to six of us, and this was pre-COVID. And then during COVID, we doubled, and we ended up at 12, 13. I think at the peak, it was 15. It's back down to about 12, 13 because a bit of attrition. And now we're at that stage again where we're looking to hire another three or four people. So you're moving from, let's say, 13 to probably 20 in the next year or so, which is going to be quite transformational in the sense that you've gone from a very small, small team of four to 20 in the space of a year and a half, which is, it's interesting, not only culturally, but also, you know, economically, financially. You've got to sit and figure out, a company that employs four people who are all working on one or two projects is different from a company of 20 people working on 10 or so projects, right? And so there becomes a number of different elements that we've got to think about. And the first one is money, you know, and I was reading an article the other day about whether you should go for VC money or whether you should bootstrap. And it was talking about, obviously, with VC, you can scale, et cetera. And the issue with bootstrapping is that it's harder to scale. And when I was reading it, it kind of resonated well with me because you're at that situation now where adding an additional person in, okay, it's probably not such a big issue, but adding another two or three people in, and especially when you're in a service industry, if you're not able to sell those projects, then...
Well, that was really my absolute first question was, what's your thought on either you go and build the capacity and then try and fill it, or you get the business and then try and service it?
Well, I think it's a whole chicken egg. I think if I look at other friends of mine who've got businesses, right? I've got another friend of mine who has a nearshoring business in Portugal. Now, he was lucky enough to be backed by a couple of billionaires and so got a good chunk of cash straight up. And he already had some connections from a previous business he'd run. So he was able to take a good chunk of developers with him and a couple of projects. He wasn't starting from scratch. But with that additional money, he was able to hire an entire organization. And then that fed itself. Really quiet.
But that is not normal. We don't normally set up a business and, you know, the backing of the billionaires is not necessarily that are not having to be billionaires. People with a lot of free cash available. It's not necessarily that they give you an amount of money and say, now go and use that. Don't come back for any more. It's almost like you have a line of credit and if you need it, you can access it quickly and easily.
Yes, and I agree. And he's very much not normal. However, there are a number of people who start off their businesses with, let's say, their life savings, right? So I know a couple of guys who started their businesses off. They've actually sold their houses, moved in with their parents, and have taken the $250,000, $500,000, or whatever it is that they got from that to start off their business and started pushing, trying to scale quite quickly. And for me, the issue has always been, you know, do you risk? It is that. As we talked, do you risk it all? Put it in, you know, blind faith that you're going to get it all done, or maybe that you know that you're going to have one or two other. You've already got a couple of projects in the pipeline, or do you try and take it slowly and not spend as much money as quickly? And I think it's very different from when you're starting off to when you're in the middle of it all. So I think when you're starting and there's a green field and you've got, let's say, a chunk of money in the bank because you saved up or whatever it is, spending that money in a way is you have to. Right. You have to spend that money in order for you to get moving and get revenue in and get the team to support you. However, when you're growing the business, you don't actually have to spend the money. You could always say no to business, right? You could always say, well, I'm not scaling. I'll take this on, but I'll take it on my terms. And I don't necessarily, you know, if your client wants to start a project next week and we don't have somebody, you can say no rather than trying to bring that on. And I think that's where things get quite interesting because no one ever wants to say no to business. And I think that's where you start falling into a little bit of a trap, right? Where you start over-promising and then under-delivering. And that's always the key of how do you prevent that.
So is that the challenge of winning the business and then trying to deliver it, or securing the business and then trying to deliver it? Because, you know, I would find it very hard to advise anybody that's in the early stages of a business to go and sell all their assets and build capacity and then try and find customers. I mean, it's such an issue saying you've got an order book and you need more to fulfill it. Now, risk your own capital.
No, and I agree. And I think that if you, again, it's a little bit more like a difference between service and product, right? If someone comes and they're going to order a million widgets from you and you know that you need to do X, Y, and Z to get it done, then you just go and get it done, right? You go to the bank, you go wherever it is, you know, alternative financing, even DeFi liquidity and financing. But it's a slightly different thing in the service-based industry, because you could actually say no, right? Jobs do tend to come along. You know, it's one of those things in sales, right? You never want to give up a sale because you don't know when the next one's coming along, right? But oftentimes it's actually better to give up that sale than deliver poor quality. Because if you're...
Or not deliver at all.
Yeah. And I think this is what goes back to, what do you see yourself... Yeah, what are the values of your business, right? And if the values of your business are that you have a methodology, you want to stick to it because that's the methodology that, you know, works and can deliver quality on time, et cetera, to budget, et cetera, et cetera. You start breaking that, then that's becoming problematic. Or if that methodology can't adapt to scaling or changing quickly, then it becomes problematic. So I think for me, it's more quality over quantity in a sense, because I feel that if you do a good job and you've continue to work with clients for numbers of years and they see the value in what you're doing, then okay, so a project comes along that you can't fulfill, then say no. Even if two or three projects come along that you can't fulfill, you can still say no, because you know that actually people will come back and there will be people that will, there'll be more people further down the line who are interested in your services, right?
So under promise and over deliver. Don't promise to do something you can't do, but when you do it brilliantly.
I think so. It's what is interesting in our world, especially with IT services, is that you've got everyone wants everything now and they want it fairly cheaply, right? And so trying to convince them to pay for quality is always a hard thing to do in the best of circumstances.
Well, that's a classic good, cheap, fast. I want it now. I want it good. Well, that's going to cost money. More than if I had more time to deliver it.
Exactly. And what's been interesting, just to actually go back to my friend, I was having the same discussion with him when I was in Lisbon, and he said to me he just doubles his prices if someone says that they want it done now, because it's not in his interest to do something cheaply and quickly, right? In the sense that there's a big risk of it all failing and falling apart if you try and do it quickly and cheaply, because no one's going to be paying that much attention.
It's just a truth. It's just an absolute truth that nothing is good, cheap, and fast. It just doesn't work out. One of them is a compromise. And it may be that I just need a solution now and I don't have a lot of money. Well, you know what? It won't be brilliant, but it might be enough of a sticking plaster to get over the issue. Or I want it now and I've got plenty of budget. Well, I can give you a great solution, because we'll turn all the guns on it and bring in the resource we need to do it brilliantly. But it'll cost you a good amount of money.
Exactly. So I think for us on the job front, I'm very much of the opinion that if we can't do it, we can't deliver well, either we bring in a partner that we know that can do that well and has the resources, or we just say no. But I think what is interesting in the scaling piece is that in order for us to maintain that quality, we have to be able to hire the right people. And then finding those right people takes time, and takes then time for them to train and work with our methodology. So there was always a lead time. So this is where the scaling part becomes much more complex.
And your business has got a dispersed workforce all over the world. How much of a challenge does that bring in? Does that open up the opportunity to have a much bigger pool of candidates? And how does that reflect against the challenges of trying to interview, onboard, and manage a workforce that you seldom ever set eyes on?
Yeah, so it's interesting, because we've got guys in Portugal, South Africa, all different parts of India, Latvia, Germany, and I'm obviously in, well, wherever I am, UK, wherever. In Riga at the moment. So I think a distributed team, it does allow you to pick talent from different countries, but then there are obviously the limits of wage and ability to speak English and et cetera, because everyone's got a common language. I think if you're a larger business and you're looking to scale your team and especially your tech team, then going abroad makes a hell of a lot of sense because there are, you know, countries that are geared for this. So you've got obviously Ukraine, Portugal, Poland, who are very much geared to scaling up teams. And that makes a lot of sense. And I think that in itself is a very easy way for someone to scale a tech team. But if you're looking at in our world where we are very specialized in the sense that I wouldn't say necessarily specialized, but we are working with very high quality team members, right? Everyone that we bring on board is gone through quite a good rigorous test. So we know that they're all very, very high quality. And what then becomes important for us is that the cultural fit is there. Because as you scale and you get more people in, you don't want to lose the culture that made you successful in the first place. And I think that's one of the things that I find, again, that we tend to struggle with, because you'll meet very good people, but they'll have the wrong attitude, or let's say the wrong attitude for us rather than a generally wrong attitude, right? And that's where, again, the second challenge of scaling is, right? Not only do you have the money, but can you find the right people that will fit in? And as you try and grow, those I find become fewer and fewer simply because I guess maybe we get pickier and pickier. But then again, you've got to start thinking about, are you narrowing your field too much and reducing your diversity? Which I think is quite an important question, because I think what you see often in business is that people tend to hire people that look like themselves, right? Or are
themselves.
And so you've got to be very aware of that. And again, a function of scale is ensuring that you're just not hiring carbon copies of yourselves, because you're never really going to get any discourse or any kind of new ideas coming in, right? And so this is where I think the nuance of scaling becomes very, very interesting. Are you trying, what are you hiring for? What are the purposes? But are you making sure that the people you're bringing on are actually going to just add, not just repeat what you're doing?
And is that something you think you've embraced more? This isn't the first time you've scaled a business. Is that something you embrace more now, or have you always looked for that diversity? And I love that word, discourse. It's so important. You don't get to make a pair without having some grit in the oyster.
I think over the years, yes. What's been very funny is actually that if you look at one of the last companies, Aztec, which we scale quite a lot, that was really very diverse. It was quite surprising how diverse that was. And just it was done by chance. But I think that it was a very diverse set of people hiring lots of diverse set of people. So it was a bit of a weird one. I've never seen an organization like that.
When you say diverse, do you mean color, trade, age, or do you mean point of view, or do you mean both?
Both, really. So everyone, Aztec was one of those weird ones where you had many, many different nationalities. You had many different languages spoken. And that was part of the business as well, right? We needed people with lots of languages and from different cultures and who understood what it was like to do business in Argentina, for example. And so you end up that just was a very diverse team in itself. Everyone, like most people, spoke at least two languages, right? In that company. The age range was interesting as well, in that we were the oldest, and the older people were 40, or like, well, 30, actually 38, 36, 38 at that time. And then the youngest were 22, 23. So it wasn't a massively large range, but it was still 20 years.
They're all children. They're normally in more than 15 years experience.
Yeah.
Maybe we do another podcast all about diversity, and I probably need a lawyer sitting next to me, anything what comes out my mouth. But that doesn't sound like a diverse workforce. Everybody was under the age of 38.
Yeah, so we did try to bring in older talent, and so operationally, we were looking to bring in people with a few more grey hairs. But it was interesting in that they didn't really fit in many ways, right? So the people that you're interviewing, their way of thinking was so far outlying what the reality was of the situation. So a lot of these guys that we were interviewing had 30, 40 years in the business industry. And even by then, I'd had 15, 18 years, right? In business and in tech. But what I found interesting was that those guys came in and they automatically assumed that they'll get 15% of the business as part of their onboarding package. And then they'll get X 100,000 in this. And you're like, well, no, this is a different type of world. It's a startup. It's not necessarily walking into the...
I can understand that. Sorry, I understand that, that their expectations were too high. It is more, and maybe as a soon-to-be 55-year-old grey-haired white bloke, some of the businesses I work with, 20 years older than anybody else, and part of the attraction they find for me is, you are not like us. You have a different perspective in what we do. And that's diversity. And this is one definitely for another conversation. And I know the answer is, of course, there are people who are still, God, I'm trying to find the right word for it, not diverse in their thinking. But you know, surely in enlightened businesses now, we are blind other than for talent. It doesn't matter who you are, what you look like, what your religious beliefs are, any of that. If you're good at what you do, come and join us.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, you know, if you look at the person we eventually hired into that operations role, he had 25 years experience at Western Union, right? He'd been in business for 30 years. So he was in his 50s when he joined. So he was then the oldest person. And he actually brought in a lot of discipline, I would say, to the business that was lacking there previously, right? And a lot more governance and oversight. So you do need that, right? You can't just have lots of kids running around trying to press buttons and make money, right? It, that doesn't work. It does work, but it's,
it can work.
Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily work, but it can work. But equally, if you build, and I guess this brings us back to the subject matter today, is, and you use that word diversity, it is building a diverse team of all the talents.
Definitely. And it's making sure that you specifically go out there and try and find it, right? And I think that's the key, or acknowledge the fact that you need to have that within your organization as you scale.
So what's your next challenge on scaling up, Atom?
What we've done is that we, you know, and this is over the last couple of months, is that we've solidified our plan. Because I think we've always talked about how it comes down to cash flow, right? And understanding the numbers. And so we very much understand our numbers and where we can go. Now it's a matter of trying to find the right talent. And we think we found it. There's obviously, you know, issues with hiring in general in tech at the moment, simply because it's such a hot market and there's lots of people looking for talent and not so much talent out there. But we feel that we're moving forward with that. I think the key for us now is bringing people on board and ensuring that they fit into the team and can work in our way easily. Like, they, essentially what I'm trying to say there is that we have a specific way of working and not everyone can handle that way of working. And so we just need to make sure that the people that we bring on are well aware of what they need to do from day one when they arrive. And we've been doing a lot of that, actually. So we've come up with this new initiative through a friend of mine called Beyond Brand. And what that does is that allows us to, we've created a set of podcasts for new joiners. So once they come into the company, they understand the history of what we've been doing, what we actually deliver, how we make decisions within the business, how we organize ourselves, what we expect from them, what we expect from them in their role, so that they can come and be educated initially. As soon as day one, they can listen to, you know, a couple of hours of podcast over the first week, and they'll have a much better understanding of how we work and who we are. So then it's just to make sure that we, I guess, maintain quality of delivery, right? So that it's a lot of more automating the processes. One of the next key phases of us as scaling is to start automating a lot of the processes that we have in place. And a lot of these are development processes, right? So we don't necessarily do everything manually now, but there are certain things, certain ways that we work, certain repeat procedures that we do that we can actually automate and ensure that we don't have to, you know, there's a certain amount of lead time for each project, right, of getting things set up. We can reduce that from, let's say, half a day to an hour. And if we can do that, that saves other people time and it saves obviously clients money. And that's really the next phase for us is to start. We got the bodies on board. Let's start automating things and ensuring that we are always following our own methodology. So in adding governance levels to the team and making, as we grow, you know, it was easy to quality assure projects previously, because there was only a few projects and a few of us. So we could go around and check what people are doing in different projects. As the number of projects grow and the number of people grow, we need to then have that governance in place to quality assure, you know, what we're doing in each of those projects. And I think that's something I definitely learned from the PwC days of how they did internal QA of their own projects. And I think that was very valuable.
So four main things then that I've taken out of what you've shared with us this morning. And this is not in any particular order, because all four need to be aligned to grow your team successfully. One is a fairly basic one, which is make sure you've got the money to do it. Second one is ensuring that the people you hire are the right fit, the right mix for your business. And that doesn't mean going out and hiring people in your own image. It can actually mean going out and hiring people that aren't in your image to make sure that that magic mix carries on. Third one is ensuring that when they do join the business, there's a really solid onboarding program for them so that quickly they can get up to speed with culture and the way the business works. And then number four is an extension of that, and that is about having a clear quality management approach, workforce and work methodology that they fit into, so that actually the liner keeps flowing through the ocean and more people get onto it, rather than it starts to fragment into lots of people doing lots of things. Is that fair enough, those four key themes?
You have summarized it better than I could.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. Well, that's really useful, because hopefully all of us listening into this, this podcast will at some time be aiming to expand and grow our business. And I think there's almost, you know, I often talk to startups and say the most challenging feeling element you have is when the founders add the first two or three other people on, because nothing is formed by that point. Nothing is formulated on people fit, on onboarding, on your work methodology. It's all still very fluid. It's a lot easier to go from 100 to 120 than from 3 to 6. But they all bring challenges. And for me, it's always one of the greatest opportunities when you bring talent in, but also one of the greatest risks. What if I bring the wrong people into the business and it starts to unpick all the good stuff we've done? And I think my final comment on that would be that you won't get it right all the time. Churn is a fact of life. Good people will move on. They'll need to be replaced. There'll also be bad apples that need to be removed. So, you know, accept it. It's the way life is.
Definitely. And I think just one final point there. Don't be afraid to fire people. Or make sure that you've got a good probationary period in place so that you can easily get rid of people.
Well, that's the bad apples. You know, once you realise before it they spoil the entire barrel, it's essential for you to take them out. And to be honest, they probably don't want to be there either. I can't think of ever really having an exercise where somebody had to leave the business where actually ended up being bad for both parties. That actually ended up with both parties probably in hindsight going, yeah, that wasn't working out, and we're better to get on with the rest of our lives. Well, thanks a million for that. We'll see you next time on the Real World Entrepreneurship Podcast.
Goodbye from me. Many thanks for taking the time to listen to the podcast today. If you like what you hear, please leave a review or subscribe. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, all the main podcasting sites. And if you'd like to learn more from us, you can contact Alan. He's alan@tbgp.co.uk. And you can find me at info@atomcto.com.